Devoncast
from Radio X.
Welcome to Devoncast, your weekly dose of local politics news and occasionally culture from around the county, brought to you by Radio X and the Local Democracy Reporting Service. I'm Alison Stevenson, and today I'm joined by my colleague Guy Henderson.
Later, I'll be telling listeners about how members of the public are undergoing training in Torbay to help decrease drug-related deaths. And reporter Bradley Gerrard will be updating us on the latest situation with Seton Hospital. But first, we have a special guest in the studio. Peter Harper has been a member of Dartmoor National Park Authority since 2008, and during that time, he served as chairman on two occasions. But on this occasion today, he's in the studio as a private individual, not representing the Dartmoor National Park Authority.
He's lived and worked on Dartmoor for most of his life, runs a farming business, and is very involved in organising the annual 10 Tours event, which has been putting young people through their paces since 1960. Welcome to Devoncast today, Mr. Harper.
First, we ask you, as a 10 Tours team manager for more than 20 years, is that where your love affair with Dartmoor began?
No, it didn't. I was a very lucky person in the fact that I've been born and brought up on Dartmoor, so I really enjoy doing the 10 Tours to actually give a bit back to other people who don't know how wonderful it is.
10 Tours is a fabulous event, though, isn't it? And as a 10 Tours manager for more than 20 years, is it more important today than it was 60 years ago? I mean, it's given so many young people their first experience of roughing it, living outdoors, and of Dartmoor.
I think it's far more important nowadays than it ever was, because people don't have that access to the great outdoors that they used to have. So, you know, the thing I really love is the fact that you see them get off the training bus in October and they can't even find their way out of a car park. And then when you see them come back in May, they've come over the hill to the finish. They've all six of them are together, they're teamwork, and they've done the whole thing themselves. And I just feel a real pride in what they've done.
Because people do queue up these days to kind of say that young people haven't got that kind of get up and go about them. The 10 Tours proves they do, doesn't it?
It does, definitely, because most of the people who start the 10 Tours journey are spending 6 months of our winter on Dartmoor training every other weekend. And even if they don't make it into a team, they've put up with some horrendous weather and conditions. So I think, you know, hats off to anybody who decides to even start that journey.
And it's that time of year, isn't it? It's the 10 Tours is coming up pretty soon.
Yep, 9th, 10th of May this year.
Now, Dartmoor attracts around 11 million visitors a year. It's home to around 35,000 people, and it's a place of work for around 12,000. A lot of people don't know what Dartmoor National Park Authority is or what it does. What's the role of the authority, and how does it differ from a council?
A council is actually responsible to its elected members. So you have councillors who actually make up part of the you know, the management board of a council itself, and they run it on behalf of the people who are there. Whereas Dartmoor National Park is a quasi local government, but is also part of government itself, because we get our grant directly from the government itself through DEFRA. So we have a board made up of 2/3 locally elected people who are councillors, and then 1/3 of which I am, which is Secretary of State appointed members who bring the national picture to it.
And you're appointed by the Secretary of State because of your expertise, your knowledge, your background on the moor?
It can be, but you have to go through a whole interview process. You are then sort of competing with other people to sort of bring a breadth of knowledge to the national park itself, and also that sort of management strategic outlook, and also, you know, just a love of Dartmoor itself.
Well, you've been a member. What have been the highlights or the things that you're most proud of doing? Obviously, you've been on the authority for quite a while.
The first thing I would say is when Dartmoor National Park hosted the National Parks as a National Parks UK, which is all 15 National Parks conference. And we were extremely lucky in the fact that we were getting Bovey Castle to actually sponsor the event, so we were able to really showcase Dartmoor at its best. The accommodation was fantastic, and we were really able to show what Dartmoor is about and the communities and everybody there. And then I would say that the second thing has been when I went out to Cuyahoga National Park, which is now our sister national park in America, and signed an agreement which took 3.5 years to actually get to fruition in the first place. And I was really, really proud.
That's quite something. And I'm glad you pronounced Cuyahoga, because I've seen it written down.
Yes.
And I've always thought, I'm glad I haven't got to say that out loud. But that's quite a pioneering link up, isn't it?
It is. It's the first one that a UK national park has done, and the National Park Service of America don't do these agreements very lightly. It took a lot of work. We had to sort of sell ourselves, really, to the American national parks. Luckily, Cuyahoga took us under their wing. We then had to go through all the federal authorities and get it all signed off. And then last year, we actually had the honour of paying for ourselves to go out and show, you know, what Dartmoor is about, but also learning about what their National Park Service is about.
And does that have a spin-off with tourism, or is it about understanding the ecosystems, or is it just everything? Is it just a support?
I'm hoping that it will create a sort of tourism link in the end, because there are now direct flights from Dublin straight out to Cleveland, which is the nearest airport to Cuyahoga. But it's really, I wanted people within Dartmoor National Park especially to actually look outside their day job and actually see how other people do things. And that's the only way you learn, is to actually see what other people do. And, you know, at the moment with the problems that they're going through, we can be there to support them.
So, Mr. Harper, how do you balance everything to keep tourists, workers and residents happy and wildlife thriving on Dartmoor? There's quite a big remit for you there, isn't there?
There is a huge remit for a very small team of people to actually carry out. And unfortunately, the group of people is getting smaller and smaller as the years go on. It is a very difficult balancing act. We try to promote understanding of Dartmoor so that any incidents that happen between residents and tourists don't cause a problem. Most of the things that we have on Dartmoor with tourism related are really people who don't understand. They don't understand the bylaws. They don't understand where they can park. And they don't understand, for instance, if you park across a gateway, some farmer may be trying to move his stock through that gateway. A lot of the time we have fun with camper vans, because at the moment you can only park in designated car parks with camper vans. And a lot of people seem to think that you can just park wherever you like on the moors. But it's a really big balancing act, and we have a great team that manage it. Our rangers are excellent.
I know, talking about that problem there, it was quite an issue, wasn't it, when there was snow on Dartmoor? I mean, there's snow on Dartmoor quite often, isn't there, when there's snow nowhere else? But it is a problem, isn't it, when you get an influx of people coming in to enjoy themselves in the snow?
Very much so, because the real problem you have is that Haytor is visible from Tor Bay. So the moment people see, you know, Haytor is white, they all decide, right, off we go, we're going to go sledging. And we had an instance a couple of years ago where cars were parked either side of the road. There was a very nasty accident while somebody was sledging, and you couldn't even get an ambulance up to the person because everybody was just blocking the road. And nobody sort of thought to think that, you know, by blocking that road, that somebody else wouldn't be able to get down. And then our ranger teams have to spend a huge amount of time either trying to push the cars off the road or trying to get hold of people to move their cars. And sometimes they can get an awful lot of abuse for it.
So what have you done to counteract then? What have you done to educate people about that?
We have a huge amount on the website, and our communications team are really, really, really good at having a simple message, but understandable to the public. So most people, when they come out to somewhere different, spend quite a lot of time going through the internet. And so those key messages are on our website, and hopefully that will give people a basic understanding of what to do on the moors.
Okay. So let's talk about finance for a minute, because recently at a meeting you called the situation incredibly depressing as the Park Authority faces a funding cut of 9%, meaning it will have to dip into its reserves to balance the budget. Since 2011, the National Park grant has been slashed by 50%. The chief executive suggested that you might have to start charging people to visit Dartmoor. What's your view on that? Would it be like the London congestion zone?
I think if we just go back a little bit so that your listeners can understand, is that if you had a house made of bricks and 15 years ago you suddenly found things got a little tight, so to pay the mortgage, so you started taking a few bricks out, which actually made it easier to pay the mortgage. For 5 years, you wouldn't actually have a problem. You wouldn't notice anything. Then for the next 5 years, you'd probably start to notice a couple of doors would stick, things would become a bit, and then a few cracks would appear. But then over the next 5 years, you would then start to notice that certain rooms were becoming drafty, And now we have got to the point where if we take any more bricks out, the whole house will collapse. And it is at that situation. The government are having a review of within DEFRA of their spending. So there is no point in actually making decisions that you don't know somebody else is going to actually back up at all. So we decided this year, sadly, to actually take an extremely large amount of money out of reserves, which has been built up over very prudent accounting for many, many years, to actually just tide us over until this spending review comes in. Because there's no point in making decisions and then finding something's completely different.
So if the, to use your analogy, if the house falls down, what happens to Dartmoor? That means that the management ceases. That means that the visitor centres aren't there anymore. As one of those people in Torbay who does look up at Haytor and think, I need to get up there more often. What happens if the house falls down?
The National Park has what they call statutory duties, which is things like planning, which they have to do. But everything else will just slowly be eroded. So you'll see all the visitor centres close. You'll see rights of way after storms not being repaired. You'll see access on footpaths starting to become more and more difficult because we haven't got the teams to be able to clear back the rights of access. But also you haven't got the national park there to fight on the people's behalf. And at the moment, you're probably aware of the backpack camping court case. And if that had come to us now, we probably wouldn't have had the ability to be able to fight it. So
that's interesting.
You know, I don't want Dartmoor to become an enclave or a museum for the wealthy. People worked very, very hard 60 or 75 years ago to actually get a public access to these spaces. And they make up 10% of the UK landmass. But most politicians seem to think that they're just a place on a map. But they are actually living and breathing communities. And if we don't look after them, they'll be slowly eroded away until there's only the wealthy can afford to live there.
So do you think there might ever be a situation where you do have to start charging, or is that just something that is not, that was just a flippant remark?
No, we are at a fork in the road now. And unless there is a change of mind on how you fund national parks, we will have to look at probably the American model. I mean, I personally feel really uncomfortable sort of stopping people who have low incomes actually being able to access the moors by actually charging for parking, because that's not fair. You know, people who can afford to pay for parking, that's fine. But there are people, Dartmoor and all national parks should be somewhere for everybody. That's what it was fought for.
And that's something the government was actually trying to promote a while ago, wasn't it? That more people who don't have access to the moor should have access to the moor.
They should, yes. And, you know, sadly, civil servants, politicians will all speak lovely, soft words about, you know, nature and access to nature and everything else. But they don't realise that this place that's marked on a map called a national park is actually really, really valuable to the nation. There are less and less of these spaces available to people. And I really don't want certain members of, you know, society to be able to lose the access to nature because it is so valuable.
But at the same time, controversially, me, I wouldn't mind paying a congestion zone charge if it was a couple of quid every time I go across a cattle grid onto the moor. I think people would pay that. I think if it was London congestion charge levels, I think you might have some problems. But if there was some sort of automatic system that as you go across the cattle grid onto the moor, it's £2. Imagine the amount of money that you would make from that. And I think there'd be a fairly broad public support for that, don't you?
Well, this is why we've, you know, actually decided to open up that conversation. We have got to have that conversation this year about what the public, how the public feel about their national parks. And I would absolutely welcome anybody to think that, you know, they treasure national parks that much. But it just sort of grates against the fact that, you know, a lot of people were prepared to go to prison to have the right of access across these huge areas of land. And to actually go down that route, I still feel will exclude certain people from the access to the moors. Oh, all right, great. I mean, at the moment, UK national parks, that's all 10 national parks, cost the people in the UK 75p a year each. that's what our budget takes. So if we could just improve that by 25p, national parks would still be accessible to all.
So it's not a fortune, is it?
No, it's not a fortune by any means. Our budget from the DEFRA budget is 0.2% of the DEFRA budget.
You also talked about other possible things that might happen, commercialising things, buying things, and then, you know, possibly bringing in an income that way. I mean, what other ideas do you have that could make the national park more self-financing?
The problem is with Dartmoor National Park is that probably 97% of it is owned by private landowners. So we don't have the opportunity to be able to capitalise from land sales or actually charge higher rents for land and farms that we own and things like that. And any investment that is made has to be made within the national park. So I don't see that there's a huge amount of commercial property within the Dartmoor National Park boundaries. The only thing I would personally myself like to see is us become landlords so that we can actually encourage easily sociable social rental housing, because that is something that is really, really short of on the moors.
I think that would be most welcome, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
The public. Why is Princetown Visitors Centre not really been a success then?
Princetown Visitor Centre is, as its address will tell you, it was an old hotel, and we were very lucky to be able to rent it from the Duchy of Cornwall many years ago, and we paid a very, very small amount of rent for that, but we had what they call a full repair lease. So we are completely responsible for that 300-year-old building. So as most of you will know, maintenance is a very expensive business, and of course, underinvestment by successive authority members and everything else over the years, and also just inflation, have meant that we are facing, you know, £200,000 or £300,000 bills every year to maintain that building. So it's just not sustainable when you have to think about whether you're going to employ three rangers.
I mean, the businesses in Princetown are really not happy, though, are they? They're saying that is like instrumental to bringing people into Princetown. Mm. So, I mean, you've given them 6 months to come up with some kind of business plan. But I think it seems from the meeting the other day that everyone's pretty much convinced it will close, like there is no option.
We're hoping not to actually leave Princetown altogether. We are looking for another premises within Princetown, which is a very much more sustainable, smaller offering. It's just the fact that we are maintaining a 30 or 40 room building at the moment within our visitor centre.
I mean, you have to close public toilets as well in Dartmead. That was a decision that was made the other day. They're within a car park, but you don't own the car park, so you don't bring any income. Do you think that's going to be really unpopular as well amongst the public?
If you sort of go back a bit onto the history of Dartmead, is the landowner who owns the car park. We tried to work with him for many, many years to actually share the costs of actually maintaining the car park, then share the costs of parking charges so that we could then use that money to maintain the toilets that are there. He didn't want to know because he has his own different things going on down there. And so we decided, why should the public purse actually be paying for a facility that both him and the Badger's Holt can maintain for themselves? Because they are making the commercial profit from it.
I wanted to move on to farming on the moor, which has certainly filled some headlines in recent years, changes in thought processes and policy about how land should be managed. Now, there was a comment by the environmentalist George Monbiot, who I think lives in Totnes. He's got a house in Totnes these days, that upland areas of Britain were being destroyed by sheep grazing. We've got the right man in the studio for this. That put the cat among the pigeons a little bit. Later, Natural England announced plans to reduce the number of animals to let nature thrive, causing further outcry. Why was that so controversial, and what's happened since?
It's an interesting one, this, because I have quite a lot of history with George Monbiot, because I, as chair of the National Park, when we had our conference, invited him to speak to the National Park, because I felt that we needed somebody else's opinion. So George and I have had our differences of opinion over this. But the problem is that people have this wonderful idea, especially George, about the fact that if you just rewild everything. Just don't have animals there. But the thing people have to understand is that if you just let it all go, as people will say at the moment, there are certain footpaths, because the animals aren't grazing particular areas, because there isn't livestock numbers that there used to be, they can't get up the footpaths. So you're actually spending more and more money. So for the first 150 years of rewilding Dartmoor, it would become an overgrown thicket, which would have to be kept clear of footpaths and things for people to enjoy. So it's great to think that way, but in practicality, it's not going to work that way. You have to actually be able to allow people access to the moor itself. And yeah, no, I mean, there's a huge amount of work being done at the moment with the Forestry Commission, with the Hill Farm project, to actually try and move tree planting up through the valleys, which is what it naturally did before our ancestors in the Iron Age and Bronze Age decided to cut all the trees down to smelt iron and tin. So, you know, we have to work with the communities, and with the landscape has to be managed. It can't just be let go. And George has always had this great phrase about, especially in the Lake District, of it being sheep-wrecked.
But, I mean, you put your finger on it there, really, because the more... It's very much a working environment, isn't it? And it has been since prehistoric times.
Yeah.
And it has to remain so, doesn't it?
It does. In order to have the landscape that we have now, we have to be able to support the farmers and the other land managers up there to keep it in that situation. The analogy I always use to people who don't understand about farming and farming subsidies is that, would you be happy in a town to go out and mow your local park for nothing, for the enjoyment of other people? So the way in which these incredibly knowledgeable people, I mean, some of those families have been up there for 300 or 400 years, the knowledge they have of the moors, none of us could ever even touch on. So we have to encourage and foster those people to help us manage those areas. And, you know, subsidies in the past have encouraged them to have more and more livestock, and so then we decided to go the other way. But we've got to listen to them while we're trying to move forward, not just say, this is what we want.
So there's been a huge amount of reports on this, reviews, all sorts of things by the government. Do you think that balance is being struck then from your sort of protests over that? Do you think that there is going to be enough land there for the animals, for the wildlife, for the tourists, for everybody? Is it something that you're working on so that to keep everyone happy, or is Natural England still sort of promoting that we want?
No, I think things have changed, because there was Geoffrey Cox MP decided that, you know, there needed to be a sort of meeting of minds between Natural England and the commoners and everything else. So the National Park, again, one of the jobs that we're doing at the moment is actually facilitating the land use management group, which is bringing all the different sides together under the very brave chairmanship of Phil Stoker to actually get those sides talking to each other and understand from both sides what government policy is, but also how to manage the moors for the future. And the younger generation are really engaged with that.
Yeah, that's brilliant. So yourself then, as a farmer then, how would you like to see Dartmoor for farming in the future?
I would like to see it working hand in hand for the benefit of both tourism and also the local community. We have such a problem at the moment with trying to employ young people, because they have to live so far away. On my farm alone, I have to employ somebody 3 days a week, but they live in Crediton because they can't afford to live in Exeter or rent a house in Exeter. And on Dartmoor itself, there is such a lack of affordable or rentable property that anybody who works there either has to live actually on the farms or within, I mean, even within the cafes, the B&Bs, all the other different parts of the business community on Dartmoor, there is a real shortage of people to be able to work in these areas.
Well, we'll probably talk about that a little bit more in a minute, but tell me about the Pine Martins and their reintroduction to Dartmoor. What is the thinking behind that, and are there any plans to reintroduce other species?
Pine martins are a slightly touchy subject with myself, because I actually live right on the edge of the pine martin release area. So I have actually seen pine martins 3 times now on the farm itself. So It's great to see them back, but they have been hailed as this new way of managing squirrels and things within farm woodland, because they do so much damage to, you know, planted trees and even existing trees. But the problem is that because it's nature, it's never going to denude all the squirrels, because they need a food source. So there's only so many they're going to actually take. But the amount of squirrels there are at the moment is causing a real headache. And it's going to take a long, long time for a few pine martens released to actually deal with that. And their hunting areas are so large. I mean, when they were first released, they've gone 40 or 50 miles, some of the pine martens now. So and then you get people say that, oh, yes, it'd be a wonderful idea to release beavers now into the wild. But you need to do that in consultation with the landowners, the land managers, because I have seen the effects of beavers in Canada and America firsthand. And when your septic tank backs up completely because the water table has been raised by a beaver dam, you're not particularly happy. And I think these same problems have already been experienced over on the Clinton Estates in East Devon with the beavers that they've had there. The water table has been raised to such an extent that they're actually having problems with drainage now.
Is there a downside to having pine martens in?
I don't see a downside, except the fact that you cannot use certain types of traps now for squirrels, because a pine martin is the same size as a squirrel, and you could end up, and I would never want to injure or kill a pine martin.
Let's talk about the planning then. Let's go back to that. And it is hard to get planning permission on Dartmoor. You've touched there about you'd like to see more social housing. How do you manage that with the planning laws as they are? Because I sit through a lot of planning meetings and it looks like the environment takes centre stage there. Even redundant buildings, it's hard to refurbish them into homes. How do you get around all of this to get what you want?
You can't work your way round it, because we have to sit within a certain guidelines which come into our national park plan and our planning strategic documents. We have great books of documents that actually guide our decisions. But I think we work ultimately to a thing called the Sandford Principle, which means that nature and the environment top everything else. So if something is going to affect either nature or the environment, that will top everything else. So you have a very difficult balancing act within Dartmoor itself. I mean, you have a lot of people who will buy a very small house, but then bring in a London architect who wants to put this massive piece of glass and steel in, and it's meant to be cutting edge. And we're just called, you know, Luddites, because we don't understand what modern architecture is about. But when you can see that glass reflecting from 30 miles away, that's actually going to have a visual impact on the countryside. So we're not popular in a lot of the decisions we make, but we try to do the best we can. And we have actually, in the last 2 years, granted permission for 64 affordable houses in bigger developments.
I remember Andrew Cooper saying something in a Dartmoor National Park meeting that I was at about people who think they can build something out of grand designs in the middle of the moor because there's no one around them, but you can see it from miles and miles away.
Yes, and we've had to grapple with solar panels, because we've actually managed to now get people to install solar panels which don't have that horrible silver lining around the edge of them, because people don't understand how reflective, you know, some of those solar panels were. But the, you know, technology has moved on, and it's really benefiting the community within Dartmoor now from having solar panels. So we have evolved with what's needed.
So within the national park then, are there certain rules how you build things? Do they have to look much more like they're linked in, or, you know, in keeping with the environment than they would be, say, in you know, another community outside of the park?
I don't know if you've had the joy of seeing the National Park Design Guide, but that is a document that is laid out about how to give guidance to prospective people who want to build, or to architects, on how we would like to see properties look within the national park. So that's the go-to document for most people to look at.
Before we let you go, there's an elephant in the room that I wanted to mention to you. And when we were talking about how Dartmoor might evolve, inheritance tax. We hear our local MPs talking a lot about how it might affect farming in Devon, farming families who may be forced to sell up or at least sell part of their land in order to meet these new inheritance tax thresholds that are being talked about. Do you see that changing the shape of Dartmoor?
I do, because unfortunately, with any legislation, if you don't think about how you put it together in the first place, you're trying to use a sledgehammer to crack a very small nut. There are huge abuses to the inheritance tax rules at the moment within farmland. I mean, people have realised who've got, you know, large amounts of wealth that if they invested into land or forestry, they can exclude themselves from inheritance tax. But there should have been some thought made for a family farm test so that you can actually show that this is not just a huge mega million business or even somebody who still lives in London and just owns the property. But there seems to have been no flexibility within that at all. And I think it will, over time, as I've said before, with this sort of chip, chip, chip away, you're eroding the foundations of being able to manage this fabulous landscape. So if you lose those families because they decide or their siblings decide that there's no point in bothering anymore because I've got to pay off a huge inheritance tax bill, they won't bother and we'll lose them forever. And once they've gone, they've gone.
And finally, Mr. Harper, what makes Dartmoor special to you?
The fact that you can go up there and you can have a head full of problems and everything going on in your life, and you can get up into the middle of the moor, you won't see another person, and it just completely clears your head. I've been up checkpointing many times when all sorts is being thrown at you at home, and you get up on that moor, you walk out into the middle of the moor, beautiful, clear, sunny day, and your brain is just completely cleared. And that's what I want to see other people to be able to enjoy.
Our guest today in the studio was Peter Harper, who's been a member of Dartmoor National Park Authority since 2008 and has served as chairman on two occasions during that time. Today he was with us in his capacity as a private individual and not representing the Dartmoor National Park Authority. Now, you may not have heard of the Torbay Naloxone tribe before, but they're a group of people who are out on the streets of the English Riviera equipped to save lives. They're all people who have their own experiences of drug and alcohol addiction and want to give something to the community as champions of what could be an absolutely vital intervention. Now Torbay Council and Torbay Recovery Initiatives have joined them in launching a project to take naloxone onto the streets. It's a drug which can reverse the effects of an overdose if administered quickly. It can help restore the breathing of a casualty experiencing opioid overdose and buy time before an ambulance arrives. Tribe members train other people to use naloxone with the aim of reducing the risk of drug-related deaths. I met consultant George Charlton, who's overseeing the project in Torbay. He says his own experiences have been key to the project.
So I'm somebody who has a lived experience of addiction issues. I think age of 19, 20-year-old, started using substances recreationally. Ended up kind of going down a place where that ended up using drugs in a way in which was just really harmful for me in some ways. I was medicating a lot of adverse childhood experiences and trauma. So as a young man, I suffered with emotional, physical, sexual abuse. So I ended up obviously kind of in a place where I started medicating using substances as a means of dealing with adverse childhood experiences and traumas. Obviously, my drug use went from being recreational to getting us to a place where I couldn't bear to be present in my own life, and my drug use became a lot more irresponsible in some ways in terms of the substances that I was taking. Obviously started using opiate-based medication without having any real place to ask those questions about staying safe and reducing harm. And as a result of that, ended up kind of having countless overdoses and naloxone being used in order to save my life, you know. So I ended up in some dark places through addiction, jails and institutions and locked psychiatric units, and probably lost about 15 years of my life to addiction, you know, before kind of finding my way out and then realizing that kind of that those experiences, which I initially thought were kind of like terrible experiences to have, could be really positive experiences to be able to help other people.
I asked him what the current project in Torbay entails.
So typically, if you want access to naloxone, you've got to either be in drug treatment or you've got to come to a physical building in order to be able to get it. So not everybody's in drug treatment, and members of the general population have got no reason to come to a drug treatment service. So I guess the aspiration for this project was, how can we train people up who've got lived and living experience of addiction? How can we coach and train them to use this prescription-only medication and then fill backpacks of the stuff and then literally go out into the community and tap up anybody who will give us 5 minutes? Now, in that 5 minutes, obviously, we're going to do a demonstration of how to use the naloxone kit, how to spot the signs and symptoms of an overdose, what to do in the event of an emergency. And then we do a demonstration how to use the kit, with the end result being that we're going to physically give a naloxone kit away to anybody that'll take it. But also what it allows us to do is to have some of those conversations with people where they kind of they get to realize that drug users aren't animals and monsters, and that kind of way with people who've got a backstory, man.
So can it really save lives in somewhere like Torbay?
It probably already has. I think the peers have been responsible for, the project's been going now for 12 weeks. The peers, the Torbay and Naloxone Tribe peers, have been absolutely fantastic. They've supplied over 100 kits, both in the service and out in the community. So that Naloxone now is in the hands of people who are out and about in the community, walking about, and kind of if they come across an overdose, they're equipped to deal with it. What we know is that between 18 and 21 people will die today of a needless and avoidable drug-related death. Two-thirds of them involve an opiate. So all of those people in Torbay who are walking around with that naloxone kit today are equipped to be able to respond. And I just think, like, for me, it's putting a massive shout out to Torbay Recovery Initiatives, to the commissioning team, to the peers, to Devon and Cornwall Police, and everybody working together to just make this a really great project. And peer-to-peer naloxone's just the start. We've got bigger plans in terms of doing dry blood spot testing, handing out injecting equipment out into the community, doing drug litter collection so we can clean up the local area, sexual health and condom supplies. So we want to just have this real visible presence. You know, we've got our pink t-shirts on saying, ask me about naloxone. But these peer-led projects are really, really important. And I think for me, it's the Torbay community's just got behind it, man. They've got behind it. They're allowing the peers to train people up. So, you know, man, if you see us in pink and we're out and about and we ask you for 5 minutes of your time, please give it, because like this bit of education could definitely save someone's life.
Among those to have been trained in how to administer naloxone in an emergency is Torbay Councillor Hayley Tranter, who's the Cabinet Member for Adult and Community Services and Public Health. I asked her how the training had gone.
That was really simple. I got asked a few questions about what my previous knowledge is. And then I was shown how to administer naloxone, which is very, very simple. I've now got my own naloxone that I keep with me or in my car at all times. And I feel confident that I'd be able to treat somebody if I saw somebody that had taken an overdose. So there's a three-twist process. So you twist the box open, you twist the end of the needle off, and you twist the other end of the needle on. There's then five doses within that needle. You give the first meal and wait 2 to 3 minutes. If nothing happens, if the patient doesn't come around, you administer the next meal, and you keep going every 2 to 3 minutes. Hopefully, by that time, the paramedics will have arrived and they can assist. Anybody could learn it, though. My training has just taken about 4 minutes, and I literally now carry this little box around with me so that I can administer anywhere.
With a project such as this, in the background, there's always a little undercurrent from people who say it's just enabling people to use illegal drugs. This is a myth that Hayley Tranter is eager to dispel.
We're not enabling people to take illegal drugs. We're helping if they've taken an illegal drug and they've taken an overdose. Maybe they've been released from prison and they've taken a dose that they used to take previously. That's too much for them. Their body can't cope. They've taken an overdose. What we need to remember is that these people are somebody's child, somebody's mum, somebody's dad. These people didn't set out in life. They didn't go to their careers interview and say, what do you want to do when you're older? I want to be a homeless drug addict. That was not their life choice. This has happened through trauma. What we're doing is reaching people that wouldn't necessarily reach out to drug and alcohol services. We're going out in the community and finding those people. There is a myth around we're supporting, if you've done this training, then you're supporting somebody to take illegal drugs. I think that is coming from a perspective of somebody that maybe hasn't done their trauma-informed practice training, or somebody that drug use has never touched their lives, and you know that's a great thing for you, but actually this is going on all around us in the community. This is not just a Castle Circus problem. This is going on all across Torbay, so as we need as many people as possible to be trained.
Out in the town centre, the Torbay Naloxone tribe have been getting to work, talking to people about their mission and training volunteers to be in the front line. I talked to tribe member Lee about the scale of the issue in the bay.
Yeah, it's massive. Massive. Been such a small community as well in Torquay, you know, it's more prominent. But up and down the country, worldwide, it's, you know, drugs. It's not going away. It's not going away, and it's just so positive to blow this stigma out of there. Out the water, which was what we're trying to do. You know, the people who are, people haven't chosen to become addicts. You know, there's a lot of trauma and there's a story to every person. Nice people take drugs and they need to be loved and cared for.
Nice people take drugs. That's one of the tribe's mantras, meaning that it's an issue that affects all people in society, all sections of society, in the same way. Here's George Charlton again, talking about the stigma that goes with drug use.
You know what's mad, right? It's like, when you think about it, right? Alcohol kills more people every year than all illegal drugs combined. However, we don't hear, like, we don't, alcohol's legal. We don't say that it's not a harmful drug. We acknowledge that it is. And we put regulations and safeguards around it. And we allow people to have their bodily autonomy in terms of what they're going to put in. But when it comes to drugs, we vilify, we demonize, we stigmatize, and we shame. And what we do is we push people into corners where that their drug use does become really, really risky. So nice people do take drugs. I think I think it was something like 3.2 million people used an illegal drug last year. It's about around about 11% of the UK population. The United Nations Office of Drugs and Crime reckon that around 10 or 15% of people who use drugs globally are medicating pain and trauma. And those are the people typically we're concerned with, you know. So when people are being kind of really down on people who use drugs, I think we need to recognise that their experiences are based in childhood sexual abuse, in kind of pain and trauma as young people. And I think if we can think more about those people from that perspective and look in the whites of their eyes and recognise that just the same as yours and mine, then we can do something about tackling those drug-related deaths.
The Torbay Naloxone tribe trying to end the stigma around drug use and saving lives as they go.
That's really interesting, Guy. Let's hope it makes a real difference. You're listening to Devoncast, which is available on the Radio X website and app, from your regular podcast provider, and on Devoncast Radio, which is on DAB digital radio across most of the county. Now we head over to East Devon, where frustration about red tape that has prevented an empty hospital wing being used has re-emerged as campaigners continue their long battle. Empty since 2017, the former ward at Seaton Community Hospital has been the focus of local campaigners and politicians who are keen to locate health and wellbeing services in the vacant space. Jack Rowland, the chair of the Seaton Hospital Steering Group, addressed Devon County Council's Health and Adult Care Scrutiny Committee this week about the issue. Among his complaints were the fact that the third party had secured funding to provide dementia care services in the disused ward, but that a lack of decision-making by the NHS meant the deadline within which that cash had to be used had now expired. Furthermore, there's incredulity that NHS Devon is paying rent to NHS Property Services on the empty space, and that the health service has used elections, budgets and policy rewrites as reasons why progress has had to be paused. Our colleague Bradley Gerrard spoke to Mr. Rowland and asked him what the latest was in relation to the Seaton Hospital ward.
We had a series of monthly meetings starting at the beginning of 2024 with a target of producing a new business plan. We met that target in June, submitted that. We then heard back because an MP was a member of our steering group. The general election had been called and they cited Purdah as being a reason as to why they couldn't talk to us until the general election was out of the way. And we were then told, oh, we understand now that the new Chancellor is going to be making an autumn budget statement and there could be implications for the NHS. So again, we had to wait until after that announcement to see if there were any implications. We followed up again after that announcement was out of the way because we couldn't see anything that would stop us having those negotiations still. So we managed to meet again in November. We were then told by NHS Property Services that they were in the throes of revising their, what they call their community social prescribing policy. And that could have implications on how they approached our business plan.
That policy then, because it's quite a long title, but is that policy broadly in relation to what you're proposing to do, is the way the NHS looks at services that could help provide preventative care in the community.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So it's a national policy. It wouldn't be just confined to our area. So we were told then that they were hopeful of getting this new policy out to us early in the new year. Heard nothing in January. Followed up in February and was told that the Executive Board of NHS Property Services were going to be discussing it on their meeting on the 25th of February. We were then told, yes, it was discussed, but there's still some revisions they need to make, and it'll be discussed at their next Executive Board meeting, which is not until sometime in April.
And you were at a Devon County Council meeting earlier this week, as we're talking, it's just about the end of March. And you raised the issue of your campaign there at the meeting. And there was someone there from the NHS who said in the meeting, as on the microphone, that they would sort of take on board what you had said. And they were due to have a meeting with someone in, I think they said NHS Property Services, and they would bring that up with them. Did you have any further discussions with that person? Are you hopeful that that person will actually convey your frustrations and your messages upwards, so to speak?
I sincerely hope so. I mean, he implied that he was going to be involved in a meeting the next day and that I'd hear back from somebody. And I haven't heard anything back yet, but I will be following up early part of next week. So at least I'll give them about a week.
And there are frustrations that you've entered at the meeting as well. So there was a third party that had sort of found funding to potentially deliver dementia care services in the wing of Seaton Hospital. They'd secured funding externally, but the deadline for them to use that has now passed because of all this to and fro with the NHS. And you were clearly frustrated about that at the meeting. And I guess it must be annoying for you because you're working so hard to bring all these groups together to create this service or mix of services in Seaton. And it just, as time drags on, that all becomes more challenging, I'm presuming.
Well, it does, because when we produced the business plan last June, we had brought a number of third-party organisations together in one meeting to find out, to gauge their interest. And from that discussions then, we obtained sort of firm expressions of interest about them taking space. And we had actually planned out as well the individual space that those organisations could take in the empty wing to demonstrate as well that we've got firm interest to back this up. But now that we're 9 months past since we did that, there's always the danger that those people will either have found alternative arrangements or their situation might have changed in the time being, who knows. So we've been trying to keep them interested in all that time. But of course, they start to lose potentially a little bit of faith in us, thinking, is this ever going to materialise? Because some of them know, having been involved in the previous business plan as well, how long this has been dragging on now. That's where my frustration comes, and why I'm trying to raise this issue as widely as possible, just to make as many people aware as possible about the situation that's going on.
And finally, then, Jack, you are a persistent person, clearly, because this has been going on since 2017. But can you tell us your optimism for an outcome here? Are you hopeful that after all this time, soon you are going to see this idea of yours and the community's come to fruition?
I sincerely hope so, because I think there's recognition both in the Integrated Care Board and the NHS Property Services about how adamant we are that we want to see this building fully used to its best use for the community. And having been involved in this for 8 years now, I'm not going to give up now. There's a lot of real skills and experience in our steering group and a real push to get this actually finalised. I'm always optimistic that we can achieve something. And I was always very optimistic as well that with the Labour government coming in, some of the news that comes out from Wes Streeting as the health minister is that he wants to see community hospitals brought back into full use for the benefit of the community, to bring services closer to where people live. I'm just hoping that translates into helping us achieve what we want to achieve in Seaton with the hospital as well.
That was Jack Rowland, chair of the Seaton Hospital Steering Group, talking to our colleague Bradley Gerrard. The area's MP, Richard Ford, who is a member of the Hospital Steering Group, said it had been frustrating that NHS Property Services had held things up and had done very little to support our work. Local people in and around Seaton are rightly anxious about the future of their hospital, he told us in a written statement. Their voluntary contributions help build it, but we find NHS Property Services own it, despite us having no recollection of ever having given it over to them. The local steering group is continuing to work at all levels to protect Seaton Hospital. A spokesperson for NHS Devon, who was at the Devon County Council meeting where Mr. Rowland raised his concerns, stated that he would be raising the issue with NHS Property Services. NHS Devon said it was not paying rent on any empty buildings, but that it did have some vacant space which does incur a cost, a figure that will be revealed when it publishes its next accounts. We'll be keeping on top of this story in the weeks and months ahead to see whether there's any movement.
That's Devoncast wrapped up for another week. Thank you for listening, wherever you're listening and whatever you're doing while you listen. Don't forget to subscribe, and remember you can find us on Devoncast Radio on DAB across most of the county. We'll be back next week. Catch the latest episode of Devoncast every Friday at radiox.co.uk or wherever you get your podcasts.